History of Persia is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is a special first for the history of Persia. I'm sure I've mentioned this before, probably even announced that it was about to happen before, but after many technical issues, I'm finally able to start releasing the new recordings of the early episodes. Even if you are binging through, if you have gone in order, it's been a while since you listened to Episode 1, Assyria and Setting the Stage. Well, in the grand tradition of indie podcasting, the audio quality and pacing of those early episodes is not great. I have improved personally, as has my equipment, over the last 5 years. And since I no longer have the original master recordings for the first 10 episodes, it only made sense to make some new ones. Hopefully, I can impress some new listeners and make some much-needed updates and corrections in those early scripts. As of now, I have the first 3 recorded, and episode 1 is actually up in the feed already. I want to make sure I redo the first 15 episodes over the coming months. Today and next week, I will be releasing the remastered versions of episodes 1 and 2 in the main feed, so you don't have to go all the way back to the beginning and find them. These are the ones where I discussed the world before the rise of Cyrus the Great and the Persian Empire. They are also the 2 episodes that got the most revision. Episode 1 almost doubled in length, actually. When I launched the History of Persia, I didn't have quite as many resources to find information and wasn't sure how relevant pre-Iranian history of modern Iran would actually be. I was also being very conscious of the existing History of Iran podcast that fizzled out while trying to cover all of that stuff. Turns out, it was more relevant than I expected at the time, and since I've done research on the Elamites and the other Bronze Age cultures of Iran, I wanted to add that into the original episodes. So, in addition to the remastered versions of the original scripts, that information has been added about those cultures and their history. Hopefully, if you skipped those episodes for whatever reason, you might have cause to go back and listen to episodes that you've passed up. And if it's been a while, I know for some of us it's been 5 years, this will be a good refresher on where it all began. So, take it from the top. Hello everyone, welcome to the History of Persia, Episode 1, Setting the Stage, Remastered. So Episodes 1 and 2 are going to have the biggest changes in these first few remastered episodes. The simple fact of the matter is that I had done a ton of research on the Persians, and rushed through a summary of everything before that in about an hour of audio. I've spent a lot of time learning more about that everything before period in the last few years, and want to include that, especially topics that I skipped over, because I wasn't sure how relevant it would be in the long run, which then turned out to be very relevant in the long run. This will extend the runtime of these episodes just a little, and also involve splitting episodes 1 and 2 between two relatively distinct time periods and topics. It really makes these two into something more like 4 mini-episodes. And to highlight that, I'm going to stick an ad break in between those two time periods, mostly to indicate the transition between those as a good pausing point if you want to come back later. In episode 1, the mid-episode break will mark the transition between mostly original script and entirely new material. So, off we go. As much as I want to dive right into the Persians themselves, they were the product of the world around them. So we will be starting with a brief overview of the Near Eastern world and its history as it stood on the precipice of Persian conquest in the 6th century BCE. Choosing a starting point for the history of the Near East is practically choosing a starting point for the history of the world. More than 5,000 years ago, it was already home to the first cities, written language, and empires. Originally, this episode started with me saying that it is tempting to go all the way back, but I want to avoid it. I am going to start you off with the original script because it's still a really good introduction to regional geography with a narrative. But since I get to reconsider my decisions, part 2 of this double episode will go back to the beginning of recorded history, but probably not the part you are familiar with. Also, if you're not already familiar with the geography of the ancient Near East, I do recommend pulling up a map. I have maps of the historical states up on the website historyofpersiapodcast.com, and will try to reference modern locations and help you match things with a modern map. Fortunately, history provides us with a convenient starting point to begin our narrative at the end of the 10th century BCE, as the Near East and the Eastern Mediterranean worlds emerged from a prolonged Dark Age. Over the course of the 12th century BCE, a calamity called the Bronze Age Collapse swept from Greece and Egypt to modern Iran. Trade routes collapsed and the Near Eastern world fell into a period of economic recession. Tin and copper, necessary to make the bronze tools that dominated the age, became difficult to import as trade routes broke down, eventually leading to the widespread development of ironworking. Once great cultures like the Mycenaean Greeks, the Hittites, and the Babylonians collapsed under military invasions and probably famines, these same disasters stunted and diminished Egypt, Assyria, and Elam. Written records from across the region are either rare or entirely absent from the mid-1100s to the late 900s. There is widespread evidence for internal violence and strife in many kingdoms, as well as invasions from outside forces such as the Aramaeans in Babylonia, Phrygians in Anatolia, the mysterious Sea Peoples, who are probably mostly Mycenaean Greeks, in Egypt and Canaan, and a group of people who you may have heard of called Iranians entering modern Iran for the first time. The story of recovery and a short geographical tour of the ancient Near East begins on the Levantine coast in the region of Phoenicia, which included parts of modern Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. A map of all of this is available on the website. Phoenicia is the name used by ancient Greeks to describe the region called Canaan in the Bible and other Semitic language texts. Modern scholarship tends to follow the biblical precedent and use Canaan to describe the region in the Bronze Age, prior to the rise of the Hebrew kingdoms of Israel and Judah, while Phoenicia is used to describe the city-states that maintained open pagan Canaanite culture to the north of the biblical kingdoms, mostly in modern Lebanon. The Phoenician cities of Tyre, Sidon, Byblos, and Arwad cannot accurately be described as recovering from the Bronze Age collapse, as they did not suffer from the disasters of the 12th century. They probably suffered economically as their international trade partners collapsed, but the Phoenicians themselves carried on. Over the following centuries, while their neighbors tried to regain their footing, the Phoenicians became the masters of luxury goods like quality timber and rare dyes. However, their real fame comes from the Phoenician reputation as the great seafaring merchants of the ancient world. In the 12th and 11th centuries, they began exploring the whole Mediterranean, and by the 10th, they had established ties and colonies as far away as modern Spain and Morocco, including the city of Carthage, which would become the rival of Rome some 700 years later. Phoenician merchants eventually became famed in the classical world for their crafts and artwork, but few of them have survived to the modern day. Likewise, their written records and histories are largely lost. Greek and Roman authors apparently used Phoenician sources, but today they are only known to us indirectly because those Greek and Roman authors cited them. Despite this, the potential greatest legacy of the Phoenicians comes from their writing, the alphabet. Alphabetic writing systems appear to have developed in the Sinai Peninsula or northern Egypt during the late Bronze Age and spread to the Phoenicians relatively early. But it was through Phoenician trade that system spread out to their neighbors, like the Greeks, Hebrews, Aramaeans, all during the Dark Age. And from there, it would spread still further to Latin in the west, Persian in the east, and many, many others over time. North of the Phoenician cities were the Neo-Hittite kingdoms of Anatolia and northern Syria. How much actual continuity of blood there was in the ruling class is hard to determine, but there is clear evidence of cultural continuity from the Hittite Empire that collapsed in the 12th century. Assyrian records continued calling the territory Hatti, and they continued using the Hittite hieroglyphic writing system, albeit to write in a different but related Luwian language. Kings of the various Neo-Hittite kingdoms claimed descent from ancient Hittite rulers, but none of these minor states ever recaptured the territory of the former empire. We also know very little about how the Neo-Hittite states were organized, not even the exact system of government. Despite not leaving detailed documentation or wielding significant political power, they grew wealthy by controlling overland trade routes from east to west, and remained famous because they interacted with Judah during the biblical period. Of course, some of those trade routes doubtlessly connected to the Phoenicians, but many of them diverted north across Anatolia, which is modern Turkey, and into Europe, specifically Greece. The Greeks had suffered particularly hard conditions in the Bronze Age collapse. In the late Bronze Age, the Mycenaean civilization dominated mainland Greece and the surrounding islands. The Mycenaeans built monumental palaces and evidently became quite wealthy via maritime trade and participating in foreign wars. But in the 1100s BC, the world seems to have collapsed around them. Palaces and cities were burned and abandoned. Their writing system, called Linear B, vanished entirely. This truly dark age for the Greeks actually lasted longer by centuries than it did for most of the Near East. With no written record or even monumental architecture, we are left with scant archaeological records and the retroactive histories of later Greeks to fill in the blanks. What is clear is that during this time, the Greeks were developing new political theory that would eventually emerge into their characteristic city-states and early forms of democracy, as well as oral histories and religious myths from the Mycenaean period that grew into the mythological tales many modern listeners are familiar with. However, it was not until the 8th century that Greek writing, now based on the Phoenician alphabet, reemerged. It was this rebirth of Greek writing that allowed Homeric literature, like the Iliad and the Odyssey, or the early compilations of Greek mythology, to come into being. It was also in this period that several groups of Greek speakers migrated eastward to the coast of Anatolia, where they set up culturally Greek colonies, known broadly as Ionia. Now we move south, but keep the Greeks in mind. Those of you that have read ahead, so to speak, know we will come back to them. South of Greece was Egypt, already the site of variably great empires and fractious kingdoms for thousands of years by the collapse of the international system in the late Bronze Age. In 1177 BCE, Pharaoh Ramesses III led Egypt in battle with migratory marauders called the Sea Peoples in his records. These Sea Peoples became a hot topic among modern scholars, as many have tried to determine who they were and just how much of the Bronze Age collapse can be blamed on them specifically. Despite successfully fending off the invaders, Egypt was not unscathed in the general collapse. As international trade routes were cut off, Egypt suffered in the ripple effect. Ramses III was assassinated, and infighting among his heirs and their descendants weakened the dynasty so severely that a rival king, the pharaoh Smendes, took control of the northern half of Egypt, and the priesthood in Thebes effectively ruled south. The country was reunified in the 10th century by a Libyan dynasty, but about 100 years later, a civil war rocked Egypt once again, creating instability, and within a generation, Nubian kings from modern Sudan conquered all of Egyptian territory. Immediately to the northwest of Egypt, a myriad of relatively minor kingdoms, mostly of Canaanite descent, mixed with new arrivals who came during the collapse. And if two of them had worshipped any other god, I probably wouldn't even bother mentioning them. They were frequently vassalized by their neighbors, and some are often included in maps of Egyptian territory. However, the little tiny Hebrew-speaking kingdoms of Israel and Judah require some attention for their legacy alone. Little is known about how the Jewish kingdoms came to exist outside of the biblical account. The pharaoh Merneptah recorded conquering a tribe he called Israel in the 13th century BC, but there is no firm evidence for a kingdom, with a centralized government and a monarch and a capital, until the 11th century, and none at all for Judah until the 9th. It wasn't even until the 7th century BC that Jerusalem became a clear population center. Many of their kings, as recorded in the Bible, can be verified in the historical record, but the evidence for historical politics does not always match the biblical account. Given their position between Egypt and Phoenicia on the coast, the Hebrew kingdoms were often the targets of Egyptian and later Assyrian subjugation. Moving eastward again, we come to the Aramaeans, a cultural group that was new on the scene during the Dark Age. Previously, a culture of tribal pastoralists from around southern Syria or northern Arabia, the Aramaeans explode onto the scene from the 11th to 8th centuries, taking control of smaller states in Syria, Mesopotamia, and the Levant. This was not a burgeoning new empire, but a collection of competing city-states similar to the Neo-Hittites or the classical Greeks. There was typically a local king, claiming the approval of a local god, and hereditary succession to the throne. There are few internal histories for any of the Aramaean kingdoms, and their story is usually reconstructed with the aid of outside sources, but they all agree that there was frequent warfare between the Aramaeans when not rallying together to face an external foe. Even further east, the Aramaeans invaded the territory of Babylonia as the Bronze Age transitioned to Iron. Centered on the ancient and famous capital of Babylon, Babylonia had been one of the great Bronze Age kingdoms. But beginning in 1155 BCE, the kingdom fractured. Two rival claimants to power quickly seized control in different areas, but neither could claim supremacy, and before long, a series of unrelated kings rose and fell and rose again. Some were native Babylonians, others foreigners from a group called the Chaldeans, who came in the same migratory wave as the Aramaeans, and still others came from the land of Elam to their east. Describing the history of the period, historian Mark van de Mierup writes, quote, "Most of these men accomplished little, and a political history of this period can easily read like a mere succession of names." The Aramaeans were invaders from the west, as were the Chaldeans, but it was the Aramaeans who settled in such large numbers along the Tigris River that their language started to become the new lingua franca for the whole region, supplanting the already ancient Akkadian language in many places. However, the Aramaeans that settled in Babylon were mostly disinterested in political control. That distinction went to the Chaldeans, who established firm control over western and southern Babylonia by the mid-9th century and eventually re-established a powerful Babylonian kingdom. Despite all the chaos, written records and urban life did not dry up in Mesopotamia, which is roughly modern Iraq, as they did in so many other places. Epics and chronicles were still inscribed on clay tablets that have lasted to the modern day and record the history and culture of Babylon. Supplemented with outside records, we can actually develop a fairly clear history. However, it would not be until about the 8th century that urban areas began to expand. They just didn't contract. Even as the Aramaean and Chaldean tribes became part of Babylonia, tribal invasions in the west continued to put strain on Babylonian kings, who would eventually start calling on Assyria, their northern neighbor, for aid. However, as some kings welcomed the Assyrians, their involvement would prove disastrous to other Babylonian rulers. But more on that in a moment. First, we look east of Babylon to the territory of Elam. Located in southwestern Iran, including the modern province of Fars, the Elamites bring us tantalizingly close to the Persians, as the Persian Empire would eventually rise out of Elamite lands. However, before being displaced by Iranian tribes out of the Zagros Mountains to their north, the Elamites were a powerful, if not well-understood, kingdom. Their most ancient Bronze Age records are written in Proto-Elamite, a language we cannot decipher, and the Elamite language of this later time is very scantily documented. This period of collapse seems to have struck Elamite territory quite harshly, but possibly only tangentially related to the Bronze Age collapse as seen in the Mediterranean. In 1100 BCE, the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar sacked the Elamite capital at Susa, and after that, they almost entirely vanished from the historical record until they were fighting alongside Babylon against Assyria, about 400 years later. I say the Elamite collapse was tangential to the Western collapse because it would seem odd that they were so dependent on lands so far away while Babylon and Assyria were much closer, and they weathered the storm successfully. Instead, alternative suggestions have to be made. Though there are no records that say anything with certainty, it seems plausible that the climate change affecting the Mediterranean would also have affected Elam in some drastic way. Elam was facing its own tribal invaders as well, these being the early Iranian migrants into the region. And on top of that, they had actually lost their major international trade partners to the east several centuries earlier, but more on that in the next episode. Even when they do begin to reappear in Babylonian and Assyrian records, it is still a fractious culture. Elamite kings and their rivals are often cited as seeking Assyrian aid in their attempts to keep and usurp the throne. Local lords seem to have been so powerful that several of my books characterize Elam as a confederation rather than a true kingdom. And it appears that this instability would eventually leave them so unstable that Iranian tribes from the mountains could conquer much of their territory. At long last, we return to the empire that would soon conquer and subjugate huge swaths of the Near East, from the Mediterranean to the Zagros Mountains. But this is not Persia, not yet. Located directly north of Babylonia, in the northern parts of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, was Assyria, another Bronze Age kingdom that clung to life, albeit in a diminished state. Assyria was a militaristic society, where the army formed the structure of the state hierarchy. They also left a huge written record of their kings, armies, and achievements written in Akkadian, as the powerful kingdoms of Mesopotamia had done for thousands of years. All sources describe them as brutal conquerors, their own most of all. The Assyrian kings loved to play up their own brutality to their enemies as a propaganda tool, inscribing vivid descriptions on monuments wherever they conquered. And they conquered far and wide. At the end of the 10th century BCE, Assyria was a small state along the Tigris River, essentially just a corridor between the two ancient cities of Asshur and Nineveh. In 911, King Ashurdan II reinvigorated his kingdom with a series of wars. At that time, Aramaean tribes were becoming increasingly powerful, and urban and village life was diminishing in favor of nomadic and pastoralist lifestyles. On his eastern frontier, he reasserted power over the Aramaean tribes that had occupied his domains, and to his west, Ashurdan conquered new territory to secure his borders. Over the first half of the 9th century BC, Asshur and Nineveh were transformed into administrative centers for a growing empire. The empire that began with Ashurdan's conquest is sometimes called the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Neo meaning new, to indicate that the Assyrian Empire of the Bronze Age had collapsed, and this was essentially a new entity. In 883, a new king, Ashur-Narshipal II, consolidated and expanded eastern Assyrian territory all the way to the Zagros Mountains in western Iran. It is in the context of these conquests that the first use of the word Persian appears to describe an Iranian tribe in the mountains. He then turned to his north, south, and east and conquered every state that bordered Assyria, mostly Aramaean polities and other tribal groups, but to the south he seized parts of Babylon, where he installed new kings as old ones no longer served his interests. This began what would prove to be a disastrous course of Assyrian kings trying to control Babylonian politics. In the west, Ashurnarshapal faced a coalition of Aramaean states, including one led by Damascus, a city-state at the time which gathered a force of Aramaeans, Arabs, Phoenicians, and Israelites, called Samaritans by our sources after their capital in Samaria. This coalition held off Assyria for 12 years before collapsing, but by the time it did, the Assyrian forces had already turned back. Ashurnarsipal's successor, Shalmaneser III, had to deal with internal rebellions. Revolting provinces and unruly vassals were a hallmark of Neo-Assyrian history. Their military tactics included rape, pillage, torture, and mass deportation of their enemies. They followed up their brutality with a heavy tax burden and demands of tribute payments, all funneled back to the Assyrian heartland, where they funded grand building projects and reconstruction in ancient cities. When the burden of Assyrian rule grew too intense, their subjects rebelled, and Assyria would respond with more brutal suppression and even heavier taxes. You can kind of see a cycle developing there. Once the revolts were dealt with, though, Shalmaneser III did not go west again. Instead, he turned north, conquering the Neo-Hittites and other tribes up there. It was in this push that the Assyrians first clashed with Urartu, the only major power player in the region we have not discussed yet. Urartu was a large kingdom established by a confederation of local tribes, radiating out from Lake Van in eastern Anatolia, which is now part of Turkey, but historically we can call Armenia. Unfortunately, not much is known about the Urartians because the textual evidence we have is not very well understood, and there has not been much study of their archaeological sites. After this first encounter with Shalmaneser, Urartu became a constant rival to Assyria, fighting directly as well as funding Iranian tribes from the Zagros and others to encourage attacks on their rivals. Shalmaneser spent most of his reign focused on internal consolidation, conducting building projects, and establishing bureaucracy. However, as the king aged, centralized power diminished, and his successors spent decades suppressing revolts and fighting internal civil wars. By 762, internal divisions became so distraught that native Assyrian cities like Asher rebelled. The king at the time was Tiglath-Pileser III, who not only re-established royal authority, but launched a campaign of expansion for the first time in decades. It is then that the ancient Assyrian kingdom really became an empire. Tiglath-Pileser subjugated Neo-Hittite and Aramaean states all the way to the Mediterranean coast, where he turned on the Phoenicians and Israel, making them into vassals who paid tribute back to the Assyrians. As further kings solidified Assyrian rule, another coalition led by Damascus rebelled, and was put down with craftspeople and local leaders deported to other parts of the empire. But one member of that coalition, Israel, revolted again, in an event made famous by the Hebrew Bible. In 722 BCE, King Sargon II claimed to have deported over 27,000 Israelites, and a smaller number of deportees from elsewhere were settled in the new Assyrian province of Samaria. More compliant cities, like those in Phoenicia, were left as vassals, and Judah and their neighbors the Philistines were left nominally independent as a buffer between Assyria and Egypt. With the minor states of the west firmly under his foot, Sargon II went north and invaded Urartu in 714, conveniently, or perhaps intentionally, at the same time as a tribe called the Cimmerians were invading from the north. This was a death blow for Urartu. The kingdom was not conquered or occupied, nor did it vanish. But it was never a real threat again, and by the time the Persian Empire shows up, it was firmly in control of Armenians rather than Urartians. Assyria then got to chill out for a couple of decades. Over the course of the next six or so kings in the 7th and 8th centuries, 20 Babylonian monarchs rose and fell. Some were Assyrians, temporarily controlling their southern neighbor. Others were Assyrian nobles appointed by their own kings, or loyal native Babylonians. But there were also Babylonians and Chaldeans who would seize power and rebel. The kingdom was taken by local Babylonians, usually supported by the Elamites, who wanted to use Babylon as a buffer against Assyria for themselves. Then, In 647, the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal had enough. He marched south and seized control of Babylon before turning east and invading Elam, where he sacked the capital at Susa. The invasion was so disastrous for the Elamites that Elam functionally vanishes from the historical record. The next time Susa and the Elamite homeland in southwestern Iran enter our narrative, it will be in the control of Persia. In Babylon, Ashurbanipal ruled as king himself for the rest of his reign rather than risk another vassal. With the Aramaeans, Neo-Hittites, Arartians, Babylonians, and Elamites all subservient, the Assyrians turned to Egypt. Egypt was the last great ancient power left standing, and even saying that is a stretch, as this was the time when Egypt was ruled by Nubian kings. Regardless of who ruled there, Egypt had been supporting revolts in Assyria's western provinces for 150 years. There had been several direct invasions over time, but they had never made all that much headway into the Egyptian territory. However, Ashurbanipal no longer had any other rivals to draw his attention away, and he turned the full force of the Assyrian Empire toward the Nile. I imagine his personal entourage groaning as he turned them around from Elam, at the eastern edge of the world, and decided to march all the way to the western edge and invade Egypt. But he did, and he pushed the Nubians south of the southern Egyptian capital at Thebes. He made a local notable called Necho, Pharaoh Necho I, the new ruler and his vassal. Necho's son Psamtik was taken to be educated in Assyria, and when Psamtik became pharaoh, he remained an ally to the Assyrians, despite declaring that Egypt was now independent. And Assyria would need allies. Despite being at the height of their power in 640, the Assyrians would be wiped from the map less than 30 years later. Ashurbanipal died in 627, and the succession was immediately disputed. Different parts of the empire backed different claimants to the throne, and in the chaos, a Chaldean noble, formerly an official of the Assyrian hierarchy, seized Babylon. His name was Nabopolassar, Nabu Apla Usur in Akkadian, the language used in Babylon. By 616, he controlled most of Babylonia as an independent kingdom, with plans to launch a campaign of revenge into ancient Assyria. In two episodes, we will follow the Babylonians as they build the Neo-Babylonian Empire, with the help of a newcomer on the world stage, the Medes, the first Iranian tribe to establish a true major state, if only for just a moment, before Cyrus the Great uses them both as stepping stones to his own imperial ascendancy. But first, enjoy the history of Persia remastered, with a bit of additional narrative about the very early history of Iran. I routinely wish that I knew more languages. Even right in the middle of the US, I run into Spanish speakers all the time, and my social media always has a little Persian, Arabic, some Dutch, and German. Rosetta Stone does help. It's the most trusted language learning program, after all. It's also conveniently available on desktop or on the go as an app, and has some really cool features that truly immerse you in the language you're learning. Just the first steps, like learning a new alphabet and some simple phrases, helped open new doors, and Rosetta Stone is a great choice as the trusted expert in this for 30 years and millions of users with 25 languages available to learn. They focus on fast language acquisition, without English translations to help you learn, speak, listen, and think in your new language while building long-term retention. Their true accent speech recognition also gives feedback on pronunciation, which can be really important for languages like Persian, where how you say something is very important. And on top of being available for desktop and mobile, you have the option to download lessons and take them offline. This is also all available at a steal. You can get lifetime membership, all 25 languages, for 50% off. Don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, History of Persia listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Ancient Persia, as in the relatively small province where the Persians lived before building any empires, is preserved in the modern province of Fars, Iran. But for 5,000 years, that area was part of Elam, a kingdom and culture that also included modern Khuzestan and parts of their surrounding provinces. In fact, Elam was usually based in Khuzestan more than Fars, spreading out from the city of Susa, known today as Shush, a place that has been continuously inhabited with nearly the exact same name since the dawn of history. Unfortunately, we do not know nearly as much about Elamite history as we would like to. They weren't prolific writers and record keepers like their Western neighbors, or as widespread as their Persian successors. On top of that, the Elamite language was one of the last major Near Eastern systems to be deciphered, and it is still not all that well understood. In fact, the earliest Elamite writing is still undeciphered. The Proto-Elamite script emerged shortly after the city of Susa itself, sometime around 3200 BCE. And actually has the potential to displace Sumerian cuneiform as the oldest writing in the world if scholars ever crack the code. But we haven't yet, which means the first 600-ish years of Elamite history are locked behind an opaque screen of unintelligible glyphs and archaeologists digging up pottery and fragments of metal. The Sumerian King List is basically a bullet point record of major rulers of Mesopotamia, from their own mythological version of the past up to 1800 BCE. There's a section of the list where mythology, legend, and history all sort of blend together, referencing very real kings but claiming they lived for hundreds of years. That's where Awan shows up for the first time. Around 2600 BCE, Awan, a city located on the southeastern edge of the Zagros mountain range, probably just north of Susa, led an invasion of Mesopotamia and conquered part of the region, supposedly becoming the dominant power for over 350 years, though only the reign of three Elamite kings. There's definitely some exaggeration in how long this lasted, or in how few kings it took, but it's inserted into the middle of a bunch of historical figures, so some version of this invasion probably happened. That alone is impressive, because it implies that Awan was able to exert its political and military control hundreds of miles from home, and probably controlled the larger city of Susa, all at a time when the Sumerian cities of Mesopotamia could barely contend with their immediate neighbors. That's basically the pattern for all of documented Elamite history. Every few centuries, Mesopotamians would invade or conquer Elam, then the political wind would shift, the Elamites swung back and invaded or conquered southern Mesopotamia. There's many examples over the course of 3,000 years, but the two greatest successes in Elamite history occurred in the 18th and 12th centuries BCE, and both played out because the Elamites took advantage of weakened and fractious Mesopotamian kingdoms competing for control. The first came at a time when Elam was actually ruled by the Sukalma, a title that literally means something like Grand Viceroy or Prime Minister. Several centuries earlier, the Sukalma kind of displaced the kings in terms of political power. And within a couple generations, the office of king was just abandoned. The Sukalma Shirukta led a massive campaign of expansion, allying with several powerful states in northern Mesopotamia, including the old Assyrian Empire, allowing all of them to conquer new territory in northeastern Iraq and the Zagros Mountains, with Elam possibly stretching as far north as the future site of Hamadan, Iran, another city to keep in mind going forward. Several of Shirukta's sons held power after his death, but one, Siwe Palar Hupak, was by far the greatest. You see, in the Bronze Age, Near Eastern kings referred to their fellow kings as either my father or my brother. Father for more powerful monarchs, brother for those perceived as equals, and yes, those were used for petty nonsense to insult one another all the time. However, at this point around 1800 BCE, only the Sukalma of Elam was called father by anybody. Even Egypt was in turmoil at the time, so many of their neighbors recognized the Sukalma far, far to the east as greater than the pharaoh. Elam dominated trade flowing from the major river valleys of Central Asia and northern India, both overland and through the Persian Gulf, which also gave them control of the incense and precious metals that came from Arabia, mostly places like modern Bahrain and Oman. Unfortunately for Siwe Palar Hupak, he got overly ambitious at exactly the wrong moment. Like his father, he entered into a campaign of conquest alongside some allies, in this case, the Kingdom of Mari in modern Syria, and the newly emerged but uncontested powerhouse of Mesopotamia, the still young city of Babylon, led by a still young king named Hammurabi. Best known for his law code, Hammurabi was also a conqueror, and when Siwe Palar Hupak tried to cut his allies out of the spoils of war, Hammurabi didn't take it well. Babylon and Mari allied and invaded, taking all of Elam's recent conquests by force, and chasing Siwe Palar Hupak all the way to Anshan in eastern Elam. Of course, Hammurabi also finished building the first Babylonian Empire by betraying and conquering Mari, so you be the judge here. This invasion plunged Elam into a historical dark age, where we have almost no information. The records just completely dry up, but it is clear that the Sukalma's kingdom fractured and collapsed. Records don't really resume until about 1500, now with kings styling themselves King of Susa and Anshan, the most important cities of later Elamite history. Even then, Elam remained pretty insular. From 1300 to 1158, they got involved in Mesopotamian politics through marriage alliances and limited financial or military support for various Babylonian kings. Much like in the Iron Age, it was an effort to keep the Middle Assyrian Empire away from their borders. But then, one Elamite king got tired of the constant back and forth between pro-Assyrian, pro-Elam, and pro-independence Babylonians. They were always pulled from lesser branches of the original post-Hammurabi royal family, the subordinate nobility, and then even cadet branches from those elevated noble families. Elam's king, Shutruk-Nahunte, reasoned that since his family had a line of succession going back 200 years, and most of the Elamite queens had been Babylonian princesses, he was more legitimate as king of Babylon than any of the current contenders. In 1158, he invaded and conquered Babylonia. It was a messy war, so much so that the Assyrian army sent to intervene settled for just carving off some territory and going home. Despite some initial chaos, Shutruk-Nahunte did conquer and occupy Babylon, leaving his son in command of Mesopotamia and returning home to Elam. Arguably, Shutruk-Nahunte's campaign established the most successful Elamite empire. It lasted four generations, but unlike the brief apex of the Sukalmas, they were not the uncontested power in West Asia. There were Assyrians, Hittites, and Egyptians all vying for that title. And unbeknownst to all of them, they were living through the Bronze Age collapse. It was the period of sudden climate change, drought, and famine that led to economic downturns, which in turn led to calamity and military disaster. A cascade of events destabilized trade and food security from Greece all the way to Elam, and nobody was spared. Assyria started contracting into its heartland for many centuries, Egypt fractured, and King Nebuchadnezzar I invaded and conquered Babylon out of the marshes of southern Iraq, forcing the Elamites out and initiating a dark age in Elamite history. Widespread recovery only really began with the events described in the first half of this episode. Some of the how and why of this dark age will be discussed in the remastered additions to episode 2, alongside the origins of the Persians and their fellow Iranians. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you will find my bibliography, the Achaemenid family tree, and plenty of other things, including the support page, to financially support this project. There are all sorts of ways to do that, but most importantly, there's patreon.com/historyofpersia. You can sign up for a monthly subscription ranging from $1 to $20, and access to things like ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and discounted merchandise. Even if you don't want to subscribe, you can also visit the show's store, either through historyofpersiapodcast.com or historyofpersia.launchcart.com. You can also support this show for free by leaving a rating or review on your podcast app of choice. I always love to see your feedback, but even better than that, tell your friends to listen to the History of Persia. Share it on social media at History of Persia Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads, and just History of Persia on Twitter, and everything else that's trying to be Twitter. Thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.